Hello and welcome to A History of Christian Theology. My name's Chad Kim. This week I'll be talking with Brad Littlejohn about his book written with Chris Castaldo called Why Do Protestants Convert? And this question, or this book, comes out of some questions that Dr. Littlejohn had been thinking about with Chris Castaldo about reasons why many Protestants are leaving their Protestant backgrounds to go to Roman Catholicism or Eastern Orthodoxy or other Christian traditions. And so I thought I would say, as a disclosure to this podcast, this is not meant to be in any way derogatory towards Roman Catholicism or Eastern Orthodoxy. I have conversations with many people from an Eastern Orthodox or Roman Catholic background. And I like this book and the approach of Dr. Littlejohn because what they're trying to do is think about what is it in Protestantism that is lacking or missing, or is there something that Protestantism could do better? So it's as much as anything, it's not apologetic against Rome or against Eastern Orthodoxy. It's more about what's going on in our own house. So I am a Protestant. Dr. Littlejohn is a Protestant. Chris Castaldo is. And it's more about us thinking through what is it about Protestantism that has left many modern contemporary Christians seeking more in other places. And so we talk a little bit about that and things that could be done better in Protestant circles. So I'm very excited for this conversation. And again, I hope it's offered in a kind of Irenic spirit, a peaceful spirit, not intended to be at all derogatory of other traditions. I do have a conversation coming up with Greg Wiebe, and he's going to talk a little bit about Eastern Orthodoxy as a Augustinian scholar, and he is a convert to Eastern Orthodoxy, so we touch on that subject as well. But here is my conversation with Brad Littlejohn. Also, we have many conversations coming up. One I'm very excited about is that my dad is actually going to interview me about my book on Augustine and preaching, so you could be looking out for that one. We will also have more podcasts coming up on the Patreon, so do subscribe to us on Patreon, check us out there, and you can see more conversations that I'll be having with Tom and Trevor, including our own theological journey. So Tom and Trevor and I are going to get together soon to record an episode where we talk about what it has been like for us in our intellectual journeys and in our spiritual journeys. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Dr. Brad Littlejohn. All right. Welcome to A History of Christian Theology. My name's Chad Kim, and this week on the podcast, I'm going to be talking with Dr. Brad Littlejohn. And Dr. Littlejohn and Chris Castaldo wrote the book Why Do Protestants Convert? And so this is published with the Davenant Press, when I saw the title come out on social media, I thought, well, this will be an interesting conversation, in part because I, personally, I go to Presbyterian Church, as some listeners may know. I just released an interview with Dr. Drew Martin, who's a professor at Covenant, so we were talking about, some Reformation stuff, but I also teach at a Catholic seminary, so oftentimes people will ask me about conversion. They'll ask me about what, and sometimes I'll get questions from listeners and such that'll be like, hey, why should we, what was it like for you to convert, or should I convert, or these sorts of things. And I always want to put the matter delicately because I don't want to be uncharitable or unkind to the Catholic faith and my Catholic friends, but also I think there are good reasons to be Protestant. We're using that broad label. I'm sure we could talk a little bit about some particulars if we need to on that, but be that as it may, I'm not one who ended up converting, although, it is something of a question that looms over a lot of educated Protestants, I guess you could say. And it was one that was put to me before I started my PhD in patristics that, as Dr. Littlejohn used in our podcast question, he said, use the Newman quote, to be deep in history is to cease to be Protestant. I've been told that sort of thing as well. To this point, that has not been something that I have you know, felt the need to do. But yeah, I thought we could just have a little conversation about his book. So thank you, Dr. Littlejohn, for coming on.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And I had looked up a bio for Dr. Littlejohn. I thought he was in Idaho, and I used to teach at the Ambrose School, a classical school in Idaho. So I thought we shared a background. I guess we do share having lived in the same state, but he was telling me that I was looking at an old bio. So can you tell me a little about yourself and where you're at?
Yeah, so I am the president of the Dabney Institute, founded it a little over 10 years ago, and I live at our headquarters/retreat center in upstate South Carolina, northern Greenville County, and have been here for 2.5 years, yes. I'm also a fellow of the Ethics and Public Policy Center.
Excellent.
And I did my doctoral work, I should say, at the University of Edinburgh between 2010 and 2014.
Very good. Excellent. And your co-author, we weren't able to get Chris Castaldo on, but maybe mention who he is because he's, you know, an equal contributor to this work. I don't want to ignore him.
Yeah. So Chris is a pastor in Naperville, Illinois. We've connected several times over the past few years because he also has a PhD in historical theology and is an expert on Peter Martyr Vermigli, who I did my master's work on. So that's a shared passion of ours. And he grew up in a Roman Catholic background. So he's a convert the other direction, but he certainly in the circles of highly educated Protestants encounters a lot of people, you know, converting toward Rome. So he has bi-directional expertise in that.
Very good, very good. That's interesting. I didn't know much about Dr. Castaldo or Chris Castaldo. So interesting that he has that within his background, because I think we could use this as a launching out point for our conversation. You mention in the book early on about how in a lot of Protestant congregations, there will be converts from Roman Catholicism to I grew up in a Southern Baptist context. Right now I'm in a PCA context, a Presbyterian context. And there will be people who were raised Roman Catholic. But it doesn't seem to have as much splash or as much I don't know. It doesn't call to attention the same when someone becomes Roman Catholic. And also as a person, as you say, being a PhD, I have a lot of a lot of the contacts that I have are Protestants who've become Catholic. So could you say a little bit about what the spirit is that you offer this book in? And then we can go into some of the arguments themselves.
Yeah, so I think it's absolutely correct, and it's important to note that there are, just numerically speaking, there are still more conversions that go the other way. And yeah, I think any Baptist church or Presbyterian church is going to have, you're going to meet a lot of people who are like, yeah, I grew up as a cradle Catholic, and, you know, it was all kind of just empty forms, and, you know, I had a actual evangelical conversion in college or whatever, something like that. So you have a lot of those stories, and I think it's important for Protestants who are maybe, you know, anxious about high-profile conversions to Rome to say, oh, well, actually, there's still more people going the other way. But that said, it does tend to be among elite Protestants, particularly kind of academic elites, but also kind of more, you know, cultural elites, like J.D. Vance, for instance, had a, converted to Catholicism recently. And I think my sense is he didn't grow up particularly religious at all, but probably, you know, grew up with a sort of generic Protestantism. So, political, cultural, intellectual elites are much more likely to go from Protestantism to Rome than from Rome to Protestantism. It's actually hard to think of any cases off the top of my head. I guess except, Chris Castaldo, I was just mentioning, right? So that's that's striking, and then it, you know, and it's prima facie concerning, right? You know, if it's like if all your smartest if your average people are kind of, you know, going from Rome to Protestantism, but all your really smart people are going from Protestantism to Rome, then it's like, well, something must be wrong with us. Like, they must be right. If all the smart people are going that way, then they must be right. So I think it generates a lot of anxiety among many evangelicals for understandable reasons. And so what we're trying to do in the book is to really kind of grapple with what is going on there, and is it something that we should be concerned about? And I think, you know, taking a step back, you know, our focus really is on converts, right? This is not a book. There are plenty of books out there, I'm sure. I know there are a lot of bad ones, but a few good ones about the differences between, you know, like a Protestant critique of Roman Catholicism or something like that, right? And so the things that divide us as Protestants from Roman Catholics are very important. But I don't feel like as much divides me from a cradle Catholic in many ways as divides me from a Protestant who converted to Roman Catholicism, right? Because quite often, you know, I think a lot of cradle Catholics in America have a sense of, are actually, you know, quite ecumenically minded toward Protestants. You know, whereas the convert is sort of, by definition, has said, you know, this is not good enough, this is wrong, I need to jump ship, right? And so there's a kind of tends to be a more dogmatic stance in the convert than in the cradle Catholic. And I think that I think you could actually convert quite often. I think you could convert to something good and true for bad reasons, right? Now, I happen to think the Roman Catholicism has a lot of good and true things in it, but on the whole has a lot of problems, right? But to my mind, the problems are less, I'm less concerned with the problems in Rome than with the problems in how people convert, right? Again, somebody, in theory, Roman Catholic claims could be totally true, and it could still be very unhealthy reasons to convert. And I've talked to, in fact, like Rusty Reno has a endorsement for the book, right? And he is actually a Protestant convert to Rome, and he would basically say, you know, most of my fellow converts convert for bad reasons, right? So that's kind of part of the point of the book is to kind of shine a light on what are the reasons and what are good reasons and what are bad reasons. And just to, you know, wrap up, I don't want to ramble on too long here, but definitely we do say there are good reasons in the sense there are reasons in the sense that at least people are responding to real problems within Protestantism, or certainly within the Protestant churches they're most familiar with. And I think any readers of our book will find that's a significant emphasis. It's not just like, hey, we've got it all together, why are you jumping ship, right? It's like, no, people are jumping ship, smart people are jumping ship. That means we must have some serious weaknesses that we need to address. And then the question is simply, can those weaknesses be addressed with resources internal to Protestantism, right? Can we fix our own problems? Or are they fundamental flaws that's like, nope, sorry, you know, I guess we got to go to Rome. And we want to argue that Protestantism does have the resources for addressing those issues, but we need to at least, we need to see the converts as, you know, witnesses drawing our attention to our own flaws.
Yes. Yeah, so I appreciate the way that you highlighted that. A lot of this is about, what is going on within the house, although it always feels a little strange to talk about the house of Protestantism, because that's such a broad label. What is within, you know, the various streams of, broadly speaking, Protestant churches, what is it that's making people feel the need to move? And that's a lot of the spirit. And then those, the reasons that one does convert. And so those are kind of the places that this goes. So not strictly speaking an apologetic on behalf of Protestants against Catholics. That's not the point of this book. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I think absolutely. Yeah. I mean, in the end, what did we call the concluding chapter? A way forward, right? Well, a way forward and then the afterward. Why Protestants should not convert, right? That's where we do offer a sort of brief apologetic saying, look, you know, here's why we think Rome is wrong and the Reformation churches are right. But yeah, that's not the bulk of the book.
Yeah. One of our other guests, KJ Drake, just wrote a book on the ultra Calvinistic, the ultra Calvinisticum, the extra Calvinisticum. And we were having this very conversation about conversion because he did his PhD at SLU and we overlapped a little bit. And one of the things that he brought up in our conversation as we were sort of talking, another one alongside all the stuff that we've sort of mentioned, you know, was the number of books that are written just about people's conversion. So, like, you know, I mean, I love Thomas Merton, or at least have loved reading him at times. And, you know, he has the famous Seven Story Mountain. And we've mentioned Newman briefly, a fairly famous, you know, convert to Roman Catholicism. I think there might be a conversation about his becoming a saint ongoing, but be that as it may, there are lots of these kind of high, as you say, high profile cases, even in history, where and they're very significant literature behind it. And so I, you know, another reason, again, just sort of the book is kind of interesting here that you've written, because when KJ and I were talking about this, I was like, I can't even name a book that is about someone's conversion from Catholicism to Protestantism. I couldn't, you know, like a kind of compelling autobiographical narrative.
Right. Yeah, it's an interesting point.
Maybe that's a deficiency on my point.
Catholic converts are just better autobiographers. I don't know. I thought about those terms. But, I mean, that would fit in with the critique, which we do address in here, you know, that... You know, Peter Lighthart wrote an article called Why Protestants Can't Write, arguing that, like, modern literature is very good. Modern literature is dominated by Roman Catholics, which I think might be a fair point. But if so, it's a pretty recent phenomenon. The best early modern literature was dominated by Protestants. So, you know, that would be an interesting question of whether, but then the genre of the autobiography was not really around in the early modern era. People didn't really care about, you know, the journey of interiority. So I'm sure if the genre had been around, there would have been a lot of great 17th century, you know, why I converted to Protestantism, but.
Yeah, that's right. I hadn't quite thought about it in those terms, right? Surely Martin Luther, if he had thought about it, that would be a story that he could have written. Good. So let's talk a little bit about your typology. So maybe could you lay out the three major reasons that you talk about for why people do convert?
Yeah. So we give kind of three different categories of reasons. Those are psychological factors, theological factors, sociological factors. And then within each of those chapters, we give three reasons. And some of those actually kind of map onto each other a little bit. I didn't try to make too neat of a scheme. But for instance, it's number... Two. Number so number three in psychology of conversion, the inner ring, number two in theology of conversion, in touch with history, number three in sociology of conversion, tired of your relevance. Those kind of actually all relate to each other in a way. So if I just kind of sketch those three briefly, you know, in the psychological part we talk about C.S. Lewis's essay, The Inner Ring, and this desire that people have to feel like they're part of the cool club, the insiders, the sophisticated group. And people have, you know, you have that in junior high all the way up to, you know, senior tenured faculty at a university kind of jostling for the best offices or whatever, right? And the sense that in America, you know, evangelical Protestantism is uncool, right? I mean, if you're going to a top university or something like that, you know, you can it's kind of uncool to be a conservative, period. But it's okay to be a conservative Catholic. If you're a conservative evangelical, you know, Bible Belt, whatever, that's just like you're sort of embarrassed to say that. And so there's a sense that the Roman Catholicism represents the more slick and sophisticated thing. And there's reason for that. That relates to a more, you know, that sounds like, well, you're just saying, you know, people are have this sinful desire to belong, and that's why they convert. And we're not just saying that. I mean, we're saying there are sinful elements to it, but that desire to belong and a fear of being an outsider is a very natural human desire, and it's motivated by some real flaws within American Protestantism. So that's where, like in the theological section, we talk about the desire to be in touch with history in the sense that most Protestant churches in America are so disconnected from the past and just kind of these little, you know, late 20th century, early 21st century islands with no connection to the broader, broader Western culture, right? So that sense that Rome represents that connection to church history, in a sense, is part of the reason why it has that, it's more compelling as, if you want to be sophisticated, you would go there, right? And then that relates to a sociological factor, the sense that American Protestantism has a kind of cultural irrelevance that it didn't used to have, of course. I mean, Protestantism used to provide the dominant cultural milieu in America. And then as the mainline collapsed, and conservative Protestants retreated into their, you know, Bible colleges, then they kind of forfeited those positions of cultural influence, and they didn't, and they abandoned a lot of these well-established institutions. And so, you know, you have, I mean, obviously they built, evangelicals have built some pretty solid institutions, places like Biola or Wheaton, but obviously those are just a far cry from, you know, Princeton or Yale. And they're a far cry from Catholic University of America or Notre Dame or even St. Louis University. Like the cultural intellectual capital that those Catholic institutions have been able to sustain is kind of puts us to shame. And I think a lot of Protestants seeking elite status, and I got one emphasis, I mean, that's sort of like that word elite now is kind of a, you know, in the area of Trumpian politics, I guess, elite is an insult, right? But it doesn't, I'm not using it as insult. I'm saying like every society has elites. It needs to have elites. It's good. Some people who are particularly gifted should aspire to be part of that elite. So, and if you're aspiring to be part of that elite, you look around and you say, well, Protestantism doesn't seem to have it anymore, right? So that's kind of an example of how I think the factors can sort of bleed into each other, but we do kind of treat them under these three main headings: psychological, theological, and sociological.
Yeah, I guess as you were talking, I was trying to think, well, what could be a better word than elite? And I mean, the first word that came to my mind was, I teach Attic Greek, because we were just talking about Aristos and aristocracy.
Yes.
But so to not sound so pretentious, I was just like to be excellent, right? Like we want to be excellent, we want to excel. And so there's nothing wrong with a desire to want to do something excellent and to be at a place that rewards excellence, right? Is that kind of the positive sense that you're thinking?
Yeah, yeah. And I think the part of what we want to do in the book is challenge Protestants to say we need to focus on building long-term institutions of excellence that can, you know, we need to have the Protestant Notre Dames. That part of that is just a matter of organization and coordination. You know, that's where the denominationalism of Protestantism is a problem, right? If you're fractured into, you know, what is it, like the largest conservative Protestant denomination is the Southern Baptist Convention. I don't remember the numbers on it, but, you know, it's like a tenth or something, the size of the Catholic Church, right? So, you know, when building institutions, resources matter, and when resources, you know, absolute size matters a lot in terms of deployment of resources to build strong institutions. So I think that's a real challenge, and I think that's going to require, but I do think we're moving increasingly into a post-denominational mindset. Most people just don't think in terms of denominational allegiances in the same way they did a generation or certainly two generations ago. And there's bad aspects of that. I mean, there's a sense in which people just think in terms of, you know, it's just sort of me and God, and I can, you know, I'll go to whichever church scratches my itches. But it can, there's a good aspect in terms of recognizing that denominations are simply, I think the healthiest Protestant approach to denominations is to see them the way Roman Catholicism sees the various orders, right? They have the, you know, the Jesuits and the Dominicans and the Franciscans and all that. And that's basically, those are the Roman Catholic denominations. They're like, look, we've got some significant theological differences. We've got significant differences of priority and how we think ministry should be carried out. But we all recognize each other as part of the church. So we're just going to kind of create these different structures to do the thing that we do best. But we can also collaborate on things that where we all agree. So I think seeing denominations as different giftings within the body of Christ, and therefore hopefully having a sense that in a context where Christianity is more on the ropes in America, we need a lot more interdenominational collaboration to build institutions of excellence. So
yeah. And I'm not necessarily, this wasn't necessarily intended as a plug for the Davenant Institute. I'm also a part of the Greystone Institute, and Greystone has a similar kind of, you know, wanting to be a place of excellence, and they're not necessarily denominationally defined, right? I mean, Mark Garcia is at Westminster Seminary, but, and in the, OPC, but be that as it may, you know, he has like, there's Anglican, there's like an Anglican track kind of within his institute and all of that. So is, and that's something, I mean, I know of Davenant Institute. I've never been to a Davenant event or whatever, but is it, you know, is that kind of part of the vision of the Davenant Institute?
Yeah, absolutely. We talk about it as a recovering a mere confessional Protestantism. So, you know, confessions are absolutely important, for tying our faith to history and to something, you know, that transcends just our private interpretations of scripture. But the confessions can become a way of, you know, a sort of a straitjacket where you say, this is, you know, this is the only, the only true and legitimate form of Christianity, and everybody else is at least a little bit heretical, right? And so we really want to emphasize the remarkable continuity. I mean, I think, you know, to a modern evangelical who's grown up in a post in an anti-confessional Bible church, right? The differences between the Westminster Confession and the Augsburg Confession and even the London Baptist Confession, you know, those differences are actually pretty minor. And the overlap is like 90%, right? So we want to kind of camp out on that overlap.
Yeah. One question that I didn't put in here, but is sort of it may be related, but to another one, I was just thinking about like why people may convert, and you mentioned in a few sort of sub points in there the via pulchritudinis of Newman, but this way of beauty. So you know, one thing that I was thinking, I have at least a few friends who graduated from Covenant who've become Catholic, and they're drawn to sort of the beauty of the Catholic Church. So I was sort of curious if that was something you considered as a more major tentpole in your typology. I realize as I was like getting ready for the podcast that it also could be related to something I didn't mention, which was holiness, right? There's something about this beauty and in a Catholic Mass that makes that there's a it commands reverence that I'm not so sure many well at least some I don't know you know don't want to call out all but many Protestant churches don't convey.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's, you know, the closest we come to that is we talk about in the psychology chapter, holiness deficit disorder. And so, yes, definitely that sense that, you know, this is here, I'll just read a passage here. Most evangelical churches, in their eagerness to make God seeker-friendly, have left their worshipers wondering what exactly it was they came there seeking. Nothing, it seems, that they couldn't have gotten at a movie theater or pop concert. Hungry souls wander in desperate for something other than their mundane, materialistic, digitally saturated lives, and they're treated to light shows, projectors, and interactive tweet-the-pastor sermons. Right. So, yes, that desire for holiness, which then, again, this is one that kind of ties in with some of the things in other chapters. Then we have in the theology chapter the desire for tangible grace, right, and the sense that the sacraments embody that search for a worship that has a greater sense of holiness, of reverence and awe. And then in the sociological one, kind of the tired of the, we have a section called Tired of Shallowness, right, which also relates to this a bit. But yeah, I think I would say that factor, and we the reason we don't do more with it in the book is because we decided just for the sake of focus to make this book predominantly about conversions to Roman Catholicism rather than Eastern Orthodoxy. We should have said a number of these things are also going to apply to Protestants who convert to Eastern Orthodoxy. And so, you know, readers like, you know, if that's what you're interested in, this is a useful book still, and you can make those connections. But we're not going to talk about that much, just because it would make the book unwieldy, I think, to be constantly sort of jumping around from one to the other. But I think if, for Eastern Orthodox converts, that is, in ones I've talked to, it seems to be perhaps the biggest factor is that search for beauty and holiness. And actually, I have been to a Catholic Mass, but I've never been to an Eastern Orthodox Divine Liturgy. I've been inside churches, but never in the worship. So I can't speak to it myself, but people say, you know, it's just really overwhelming. I think my sense is that's not really the case with most Catholic masses anymore. I mean, certainly not the ones I've visited. Post-Vatican II liturgy, especially in America, probably, I can't speak to other parts of the world, but, you know, is many Catholic masses aren't that different in their feel from, you know, a non-denom evangelical church. And that, of course, that's why a lot of, now most converts don't go to just the regular parish. They go to like the Latin Rite one, right? So So you can get those kind of more reverence, you know, the services have a sense of reverence and awe in Roman Catholicism, but you kind of have to hunt around for it a bit more, I think.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, maybe that's also something of why I think that Via Pulchritudinis is more significant. So in St. Louis, we have several different places that offer traditional Latin Mass, and all the converts that I know of go to one of them. And so, you know, I think like that is that definitely is something that maybe is at the forefront of my mind. I mean, I have been to Divine Liturgy and even the Holy Corbono and the Syriac Orthodox Church. And all of those have a, you know, a very reverent sense. And well, and I think it's, you know, to some extent, like, in the different services that I've been a part of where they highlight even maybe a foreign language, there is this kind of it feels other. Right. And there's something about that is attractive, especially, you know, and I mean, I'm a person who's kind of basically a lot of my research relies on my knowledge of foreign languages and historical languages. And so I may be particularly prone to liking those sorts of things. But yeah, I was also thinking just like someone once said to me that in the Divine Liturgy in the Eastern Orthodox Church, you have mystery conveyed by the iconostasis, right? So there's something about that that makes it feel like whatever is happening when in the preparation for the Eucharist communion, it's done behind this big icon wall at the front of the – or in the church. And then in the traditional Latin Mass, it's the language, right? So most people didn't speak Latin. I mean, as far as we know, Terence Tunberg, a great Latinist, says that basically Latin as a mother tongue is dead by the 10th century. So, you know, so it's been a millennium at least since Latin was a common language. So that conveyed the mystery for people. And, you know, if I think about walking into like even, I mean, I love my church, but if I walk into my church on a Sunday, you know, there really isn't a lot of mystery. So another part of holiness and beauty we could think about is that mystery, and that doesn't seem as central in the worship of Protestantism, you know, and maybe that's by historical accident or fact or something of the, you know, that they wanted, like Martin Luther wanted people to have access. And so, yeah, I mean, I'll let you respond to that. Yeah. Sorry, just pontificating a little bit.
Yeah, no, I think it's very striking, right, that in a sense what you're saying is what is drawing people back to Rome or the East is in some ways precisely the same thing that provoked the Reformation away, right? This sense that the worship was, you know, it was unintelligible, it was, and it was... you know, sort of, since it was like a bunch of sort of smoke and mirrors, that was a sort of impressive performance, but that didn't actually communicate content and the desire to make it much, you know, very explicitly, to make it very accessible to people so that the word was being proclaimed and they understood what was being said. And so the goal of Protestant worship was maximal intelligibility. And then, but what you lose in that, right, is sometimes you don't want maximal intelligibility in a sense. You want a sense of, I mean, this is like what attracts people to poetry, right? I mean, I love poetry, but the fact is most of the poets that I read, I'm like, that was really beautiful. And I don't know exactly what you meant. And it's the fact that you don't know exactly what they mean that's part of the appeal, right? Now, and I think it's hard to disentangle, like, what part of that is, like, healthy and what part of that is unhealthy, right? I think there is a sense in which we want to say, clearly we want to say that God, because God is so transcendent, and because the central mysteries of the Christian faith are such mysteries, right, that any form of Christianity that would render it sort of render God totally transparent and intelligible and relatable has obviously missed something very important. And you see this actually in kind of the Enlightenment period, which represents the sort of, there's a hyper Protestantism that goes on, where they say, a lot of these Enlightenment guys are like, well, the problem is that even our confessional Protestant churches are still too popish, in the sense that they still kind of hide behind these mysteries and so on. And really, religion ought to be entirely rational. We ought to be able to just make total sense of it. And why? And so, like, doctrines like the incarnation and the two natures of Christ, you know, that's a holdover of popery because it's this mystery. And so you can obviously go too far in trying to make everything completely clear, and the Enlightenment rationalism does that in one way, and then kind of, or you can just try to make it really accessible in a very sort of shallow and emotionalistic way, I think, that many modern evangelical churches do. So that's to say, if God really is radically transcendent, then our worship should have some sense of that, right? But at the same time, I think we do need to be careful that there's an element of that that is just a sort of aesthetic. You know, it's the sort of thing that makes people want to go to, you know, thriller movies or whatever, you know, just that kind of sense of, you know, get a little shiver, you know, about this freaky sense of the supernatural or whatever, right? And that's not, I mean, there's nothing, again, that's just an aesthetic sensibility. There's nothing true or Christian about that per se. And I think that's what concerned the reformers, is that, you know, the like, ooh, I'm going to go touch the relic, or not touch the relic. I can't touch the relic. I'm going to sort of like go, you know, genuflect in front of the relic and get this kind of like shiver sensation. Like, they're like, I understand why that appeals to you. That's like, that's a feature of human nature, but it's but it's misdirected, right? And so I think we have to, there has to be some kind of balance there in terms of rejecting the unhealthy aspects of the mystery, while without just flattening everything out entirely. And I think, you know, on the whole, I think, this is where it seems to me that the Lutheran and Anglican traditions did a better job of this than the Reformed, where the Reformed does try to just remove any of the ornamentation in worship and just make it sort of like, this is just, the worship service is just a vehicle for the transmission of the word, you know? And you get these, you can go to services where it's sort of like, it was kind of just like an academic lecture with, you know, a few songs before, you know? So I think that, but I think Lutheranism didn't go that way, and Anglicanism has had a kind of, you know, complicated history back and forth. But on the whole, those traditions I feel like helped preserve that kind of balance. Like, the worship is supposed to be, you know, it's in our language. We're supposed to basically understand what's going on, but we're not supposed to understand everything that's that's going on.
Yeah. Well, and not to belabor this point, but as we were talking, and you began with the C.S. Lewis quote, it reminds me of the book Till We Have Faces. And I used to have to try to teach that to middle school boys at the Ambrose School, and I had never read it. But I had to really, really read it to try to figure out what was going on. And I'm not going to say that the boys loved it. I don't think they did.
Yeah, I wouldn't the middle schoolers.
But that was what was on the curriculum. All that being said, I remember what C.S. Lewis laid some of this bare for me in The Rationality of the Fox and The Priest of Ungot.
Right.
And yep. the priest kind of has that whole veil and all of that. And my middle school boys, they called me the fox. That was their – they were like, oh, you're the rationalistic type. That's just you. Like I said, don't mean to belabor it, but it's an interesting way to think about why that book works, because I think that book's a beautiful book. Again, not sure it's best intended for a middle school audience, but it does sort of lay, you know, it captures this kind of distinction almost.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I have a few different questions. We've been talking quite a bit here. I think we kind of covered some of this about, you know, why, you know, evangelical subculture has a hard time with high art. You mentioned Peter Lighthart, who features in the book. I think you should go read that. So one other thing, I'm just kind of, you know, I guess spitballing, or I'm trying to raise some of the questions that I've thought about, or some of the things that I've thought about in this issue of conversion. So I mentioned this in my email, but you know, as a person who was raised again in a Southern Baptist context, we were always, you know, we had to walk the aisle when we were five or six. You get baptized as a believer's baptism. We were taught to share our testimony, and there was an extreme emphasis on conversion, right? So like the whole, you know, you were supposed to convert from being essentially, you know, a non-Christian to a Christian, but at a very, you know, usually at a pretty young age, five, six, seven, something like that. And so there was, you know, and then we would come and we would hear stories from people who had in their kind of adult life a big conversion moment. So they go from some kind of great sin to become, you know, to the sort of the purity of the church, of a Christian life, I should say. And it, you know, made me wonder, like, so if I think about my own desire, so I'm going to put this on myself and not project on other people. I have always felt like, you know, I just mentioned I've gone to lots of different worship services. Every form of Christianity we've named, I have been in those worship services: Syriac Orthodox, so Far East Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox, Roman Catholic, Lutheran, Anglican. I, you know, there's a little bit of me that's that sort of spiritual seeker, that wanted to like see all these different forms of Christianity. And maybe, you know, sort of maybe in the back of my mind was this idea that like I needed to convert to sort of prove how much I really meant my faith. And so, you know, because, if you look back on it, like a conversion of a five-year-old, like what was I leaving behind? What life was I leaving behind? I was raised a Christian. I mean, Southern Baptists don't typically baptize and talk about their children as being in the faith in the same way that we, you know, that we do in a Presbyterian context or an Anglican context. And so, you know, so technically in a way, you know, they're not Christian yet. And so they need to convert. And I was like, but I was always, you know, I was in church long, you know, before I was born. You know, it didn't really feel like I was converting. I was just sort of understanding what I was. So I don't know. I thought I'd let you respond to that. That's just something I think may be almost a pattern. I've heard other people say similar things. Yeah. I may be an extreme example, but.
No, I think that's a very insightful observation, and one that I wish we'd sort of put into the book, is that, you know, in a sense, I mean, I think our opening chapter is called Conversionitis. And we really could have said, like, let's start with the fact that just Protestantism has a problem of conversionitis within itself, set aside the conversions to Rome. But the sense that, you know, we have this impulse that we have to have a conversion experience. And so those of us who haven't had it, I think you're right, are sort of searching for it. And as I think back through my own experience, I think I had that. I definitely grew up Presbyterian, and I was sort of... I knew that we weren't supposed, on one level, I knew we weren't supposed to worry about that the same way. We'd already been baptized. We didn't have to do the testament and so on. But it was there was enough sort of Baptist influence just in my surroundings that I always had this sense in young adulthood, like, I feel like I need to, I'm sort of missing something here. And then when I went to college and I had, you know, I had a few of these, right? It was sort of like when I read Kierkegaard's Fear and Trembling, I had a sort of a bit of a kind of personal faith crisis that mimicked that in some ways. And then when I was attracted to Anglicanism, I really characterized it to people as like, I'm converting to Anglicanism, this big dramatic thing, you know, it just seems like a bit of a joke in retrospect, right? But I think it was trying to scratch that itch, right? And so I think what's going on is so many of these, not all of them at all, right? I mean, I think that I just want to say you have people like very well-respected scholars who are, you know, really kind of wrestling through things and come to the conclusion that, you know, Rome's true claims are more true. But I think with a lot of folks, you know, especially who are maybe converting to Rome in college, what you have is a very, like, they're, in a sense, they're doing the most Protestant thing possible, right? And yep. they're like, they're going through this individual time of wrestling where they need to have this deep personal experience where they're just owning that, you know, that they're, instead of just taking their faith as it was given to them, they're owning their faith for themselves, which means they need to reject what was given to them and embrace this new thing. And although they claim that it's about, you know, submitting to the authority of the Pope, it's, you know, for them, it's like, it's not a matter of private judgment. It's a matter of submitting to authority. Well, but you have to exercise, you might get there, that's right, but you have to exercise your private judgment to get there. Right now, you're saying, I'm not going to listen to the authorities that are actually around me. I'm going to exercise my private judgment and go seek out this other authority, right? So I think for many of these people, it's like they're kind of acting out a script that's been given to them within broader evangelical culture, even while trying to react against it.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's well said. All right, well, I know you have to go here pretty soon. I'll just let it. We can end with. So, what are some of the things? Some of the things that we could do as sort of as Protestants and Protestant churches to sort of shore up some of these shortcomings that many people feel. You know, I know one of them is a connection to this broader sort of small C Catholic tradition. Like I say, I mean, that's part of my interest in the Greystone Institute. And even, I mean, frankly, one reason why I love being in a Catholic, I really like being at a Jesuit university and being at a Catholic seminary. I do enjoy, people who also really appreciate the history of the faith and the broader tradition. But yeah, so I'll let you close us out with just some thoughts on what, again, trying to keep this in-house, not trying to make this about what other people are doing wrong or something, but.
Yeah. I mean, I think probably there I would sort of focus on the three factors that we identify in the theology section, where we talk about the quest for certainty, that desire to be in touch with history, and the search for tangible grace. And I think those are all areas in which Protestants could get their own house in order by returning to their roots and really reading the reformers, studying the confessions more. Because I think that first one, quest for certainty, one of the things we're dealing with there is like the doctrine of sola scriptura has kind of jumped the tracks, and for many people it's become this sense that, like, you know, the Bible is the only thing you need, and you, as your own personal reader of the Bible, are the only the only interpreter you need. And, like, both of those things are false, and they're not what the Reformers taught. Sola Scriptura did not mean ditch all other books, you know, just read the Bible. And so I think people who are thinking that way are looking for a kind of certainty that Scripture alone in that way can't provide, and so then they're like, well, maybe Rome can give me the certainty that I'm looking for. And I think what we actually need is a return to a healthy uncertainty. There are there's a certainty and assurance that the gospel gives us about the kind of the fundamental truths of our status in relation to God that should be a firm and sure confidence in God's goodness to us. But that's very different from a certainty about what God wants me to do next. You know, it's like what Luther is very, very insistent on this. He's like, what you have confidence in is that God loves you and has redeemed you. And now he wants you to sort of figure out what to do next. And that's going to be sort of shrouded with radical uncertainty. But it's okay. That uncertainty about what he wants you to do, you know, how to carry out your vocation as a husband and a father and a school teacher and whatever else, there's going to be 100 questions that you don't know the answers to. But that's okay, because you do have certainty that God loves you and has redeemed you, right? If you're looking for certain answers to all those what should I do questions, then you're going to run into a dead end, and then you're going to think, well, maybe Roma has more answers, right? On the, you know, history side of things, I think Protestants used to understand that the Reformation was very much about getting back in touch with the church's history. The best, they were saying, look, actually, the best historic teachings of the church have been sort of obscured by these new recent papal, you know, encyclicals and so on. And of course, there's a lot of debate as to, you know, who has the better claim to the church fathers or whatever, and that's a, you know, important argument. But it is important to note, at least the reformers thought it was very important to have that argument and very important to make an appeal to the fathers, even if, you know, some might say, well, they were actually right. They weren't right about this particular field appeal to the church fathers or whatever, right? So that sense that we are part of a community of saints that goes back 2 millennia, and none of our forefathers are perfect and infallible and should just be taken as given the final answer, but they should all be listened to carefully, that is part of what it used to mean to be Protestant, and we can and should absolutely recover that. And then the third thing is on sacraments, right? The Reformation was about the equal importance of word and sacraments, and in some ways it was more sacramental. I emphasize this in one of the other interviews I've done about this book, is that for the reformers, the problem wasn't, in a sense, wasn't too much sacraments, but too little sacraments, in the sense that the Eucharist was, the average believer would only take the Eucharist once a year, and they would only have the bread, not the wine, right? It was and they wanted to make it much more frequent and make it something that was actually participatory for the congregation. For the late medieval church, the main purpose of the Eucharist was for a priest alone in Latin that he didn't even understand, in a side chapel with nobody listening to him, would do the Mass, you know, for the sake of some dead person's soul, right? I mean, that's just like so far away from what we would say that's what the Eucharist is, that's what Jesus instituted it for, right? So the Reformation was about like getting back to the importance of the Eucharist. And the fact that so many churches, Protestant churches now, are so unsacramental is really a betrayal of our own roots. And so that's where I want to say, like, at the very least, like, you know, if Protestants get back in touch with their own roots and do things the way the reformers taught, and still at the end of the day, you're like, yeah, but Rome is right. Okay, fine. But at least, you know, at least give that a shot, and don't jump ship from a Protestantism that bears very little resemblance to the Protestantism of our confessions.
Excellent. Well, my guest today has been Brad Littlejohn, and he and Chris Castaldo wrote a fascinating little study, Why Do Protestants Convert?, with a foreword by Carl Truman. I just want to thank Dr. Littlejohn for an hour, about an hour of his time.
Yep. Thanks so much, Chad.